Welcome to ESIM's Global Economy Podcast. My name is Fredrik Eriksson, and today I am talking to Johan Norberg. Johan Norberg is a writer and broadcaster, and he's one of the leading advocates in the world of globalization and an open world order. He has authored many books on current affairs, economics and science, and among them, In Defense of Global Capitalism and, not most recently, but at least recently, Progress, 10 Reasons to Look Forward to the Future. His television documentary has been broadcasted by Britain's Channel 4 and PBS in America, among other things. Johan has just released a new book titled The Virus and the World. Unfortunately, it's so far only been published in Swedish, and I certainly hope it will be an English version or versions in other languages coming out in the future. But it's, to my knowledge, one of the first books published now on the pandemic and what consequences that the coronavirus will have for the world order. And that's also what I want to talk to Johan about. Will the coronavirus wreck globalization? Johan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Frederick. Thanks for the invitation.
So first of all, congratulations to your new book. It's great.
Thank you.
And as I said initially, I hope it's going to be available in other languages too. But when we began this conversation, you said there's no plan, at least for the time being, to have it out in other languages.
That's right. And in a way, that's because this book is more of a trailer, I would say, for my forthcoming book that will be published in English in September, called Open: The Story of Human Progress, in which I wrote about various threats to openness historically. And this is some sort of eerie, timely coincidence, but pandemics, historically pandemics, were one of the greatest threats to an open world and to open trade. So in a way, this book, and it's this, The Virus and the World, it's very generous of you to call it a book. It's a very short book. And it's more of a place where I took those thoughts that I had in the forthcoming book about the pandemics and historically, and trying to explain how this time around it seems like in some ways a repetition and in others perhaps not.
Very good. Looking forward to that one, Johan. And we also return to that theme about globalization and history, pandemics and history, and what perhaps we can learn from them. But I wanted us to start with the situation right now and a lot of the commentary that we can find in international newspapers and international media right now, which seems to be that it's globalization that now stands accused for having wreaked havoc to not just people's lives, but to the world order itself, that we had the outbreak of a virus in one part of the world, and then it spread to other parts of the world. So what do you say? What's your response to that accusation that globalization is the real culprit here, the enemy that now needs to be at least curtailed in order to avoid that we're going to have a world in the future where pandemics are going to spread even faster?
Yeah. Well, it's very natural, this kind of reaction, because we get the microorganisms from somebody else, right? So we think that somebody else is the problem, and specifically people who are different from us, other countries, other populations, and that makes us a bit concerned about them in a way that we didn't used to be. And in a way, obviously, it's correct. The fact that we've now gathered in cities and megacities around the world, and then we fly between them constantly, means that we have a constant interchange of viruses and bacteria. And just like new ideas and technologies that appear someplace on the planet can now spread to other parts of the world in a manner of hours or even minutes, now we see the same thing with microorganisms. So in a way, globalization is to blame for the speed of this process. But I'm also trying to explain that it's more complicated than that in my book, because it's also the case that most new diseases that we have is just a new version of a previous one. It's a new influenza strain, for example. It's just a one or two different mutations in between. And that means that if you've had the previous strain, it might mean that you have developed cross immunity. You're immune to the next strain of the virus. And that means That means that the more you've been exposed to the microorganisms of other populations, the less place there is for a new virus to develop for a long time in isolation and then suddenly explode across the planet and kill millions and millions. And there are researchers in Oxford and Tel Aviv who've modeled different rates of travel and mobility around the world and influenza viruses. And should be mentioned that COVID-19 and the new coronavirus is not an influenza virus, but this is an important part of the story nonetheless. They've modeled the rate of mobility and they come to the conclusion that our present rate of mobility, or at least the one we had before the coronavirus, leads to a constant exchange of viruses across populations. And that has probably saved us from new destructive strains of influenza that would have been much more lethal had we not had this kind of exposure constantly. For example, the swine flu in 2009, it was predicted to be much, much more lethal, but probably different influenza seasons had created an immunity and made sure that it wasn't that lethal. But we could see that those who suffered the most were populations who had previously been isolated. 24 of the 30 countries that suffered the most in 2009 were island states, people who did not have this rate of mobility and globalization. So again, the new coronavirus is a new thing. It jumped from another species, probably bats, so we don't have protection against that. But when we discuss this and the speed with which it takes over the world, we shouldn't forget that globalization and the jet engine probably has saved the lives of millions of people only in the last few decades. The researchers speculate that this might be the reason why we have not seen a new version of the Spanish flu, for example, over the last 100 years. So let's remember that before we shut down the world.
Yeah, and it's also this sort of strange concept which is out there right now, even if people won't admit it. But the notion that if you try to model your own society as North Korea, then you're going to be protected against new viruses. And we all know, of course, that's not true. I mean, I think you sort of, if not in the books, I've at least seen you written about this before, which is that, well, even in a non-connected world, in an unglobalized world, like sort of 13th century, when the plague arrives, it still spreads. It still will find its way around the world. So it's just very difficult to sort of nip a virus in the bud and kill it once it has begun to spread. And the way that you build up resilience in society seems more to be sort of on this concept of anti-fragile, which is that you're trying to expose yourself to it and gradually you're going to make not just immune systems, but societies much stronger compared to if you try to protect the population against it, right?
Yeah, I think that's an incredibly important point. It's true that microorganisms moved slower when they didn't have cheap flights, but they moved steadily across the planet, and it took them years to cross an entire continent, but they moved mercilessly because we didn't have any kind of defense and millions of people died. And for hundreds of years, for example, the plague kept returning and killing off every vulnerable person. The new thing with globalization is not these microbes, it's the fact that we can suddenly begin to fight back, because we now also have a globalization of science and technology so that different research teams can cooperate across the planet with reading the genome of the virus, coming up with the best tests and coming up with new treatments and vaccines. I think it's informative that if we think that our present world is vulnerable, we should keep in mind that it took humanity some 3,000 years to develop a vaccine against smallpox and polio. But even now, after 3 months, after we've learned about the new coronavirus, we have hundreds of different ideas for treatments, therapeutics, drugs, vaccines that are already in clinical trials. After 3 months, it's just astonishing the kind of resources that are at our disposal in a more open world.
No, indeed. And that's also why I say to people now, which are trying to make the point that inevitably the consequence of a crisis like this is going to be that globalization will have to break down because everyone is just going to resort to their own countries and they're going to cut connections they have with the rest of the world. And then I just point to sort of the intensification that we have in scientific operations right now, that, you know, the essence of globalization for a long time has been the spread of ideas across borders. They can manifest themselves in a good, in a service, but generally what globalization is about is that you access ideas in a way that you simply can't do if you try to shield yourself against the rest of the world. And if anything, aren't we now seeing sort of a massive increase, at least in scientific R&D collaboration, development around sort of pharmaceuticals, developments in epidemiology, that perhaps, you know, not to put a gloss on it, but at least should give us some hope that there is going to be a future for globalization after we have exited this pandemic?
Yeah, and that's interesting because this is brand new. We've never been able to cooperate in real time with the people we don't know on the other side of the planet who are perhaps at another stage of the development of the disease, and they have other bits and pieces of the enormous puzzle that we're going to have to build to deal with this. Previously, we only saw foreigners during times of pandemic as carriers of the virus and the bacteria, and they were dangerous. But this time around, it could be that it's a cooperation with Japanese and Korean and Chinese researchers who help us to beat it back and to develop drugs and vaccines and so on. And then it's not as easy to just think of the outside world as scapegoats in the way that we often did in the past during times of pandemics.
So even if we have that optimistic or at least aspirational outlook, so let's put ourselves in a pessimistic, if not dystopian, mode for the time being. And sort of, if I ask you, sort of, what, when you look at the reactions right now to the pandemic, are there any reactions that frightens you or that leads you to sort of entertain pessimistic thoughts about the future? And if so, what would those reactions be?
Yes, there are a couple of very problematic developments, I think, and specifically how men in authority behave in times of crisis. And this is obviously not a surprise. My book Open in September is about how we create progress and how we destroy it. And oftentimes in times of crisis, we destroy it. Because when you become afraid of the world, there's a fight or flight instinct. You try to hide from the rest of the world and build walls or fight the enemy in different ways. So we've often seen the dismantling of great eras of progress and when we've had a sense of threat. And I think we've seen that in some areas. We've definitely seen authoritarian reactions in certain countries where governments just use, or strongmen use the crisis as an excuse to extend their power, the Viktor Orbans of the world. But also how democracies behave to, could be to protect themselves, could be to show that they're on top of the situation, kind of a political placebo. They do things like travel bans and shutting down their borders, even though, for example, Europe shuts down its borders, despite the fact that Europe is the epicenter of the epidemic, which is really insane. And I've been a little bit worried and sad to see how quickly this happens. A country like Poland shuts down its borders so that the workforce traveling to other parts of Europe, like the Czech Republic every day, cannot enter factories and to produce the protective equipment that we need in healthcare, for example, or even major Western countries like Germany and France imposing export bans on important protective equipment. And not just export bans, but really piracy, stealing the protective equipment from, for example, Swedish companies who are sending it to people, hospitals suffering in countries like Spain and Italy. The fact that this happened this quickly, without any previous debate, without any real rational scientific basis for it, it shows how far they're willing to go in times of crisis. And that tells you something about the kind of attitudes, principles, ideas, or at least gut instincts that they already had about how dangerous an open world is. And it only took a crisis to get it going. And that worries me precisely because this is not the Spanish flu. It is not at all as lethal as some of the horrible pandemics that we've had over the last 100 years. And yet they did this. That makes me a little bit worried about what they would do when we face a bigger crisis next time around.
Are you, Joanne, also afraid for the integrity of our civil liberties in the West? I mean, let me preface that question by saying that I am beginning to be not perhaps fearful, but I'm worried about how the development has been, partly for the reasons that you just outlined, but partly also for reasons that are connected to sort of the, not the growth, but the spread of a single truth mentality in many countries. I mean, I think both you and I have been pretty lucky that we have, at least for the most part of this pandemic, we've been sort of both based in Sweden, a society which has remained far more open than other European countries, and where there is a pretty robust debate between different sort of experts that have different views about things. And that's how it should be. But when I have followed sort of international media, especially British media, to some extent German and French media, I've been flabbergasted by sort of the difficulties for people to speak plainly about what they think about things. Do they think that shutdowns and lockdowns have been warranted? Do they think that the economic consequences that will arise from the lockdowns are proportional to the crisis, the sort of the virus crisis we are confronted with, etc.? I mean, at least where you and I spend our time right now, there's a debate about this, but in many other countries, I haven't seen that debate. It has begun to arise a bit now, but for a long time, anyone who was challenging policies that were adopted was seen as being threats to sort of national cohesion and the mood around national cohesion. You look at that and you look at, for instance, issues like economic policy consequences that may come with the fact that sort of 90% of the market economy in most of the lockdown countries aren't working now. They're all dependent on handouts from the state, basically, to make them sort of survive this crisis. It may take a long time before we're going to come out of the crisis, which means that a lot of the companies may end up in the ownership of governments. And finally, a third factor is that if it was so easy to lock down countries right now, wouldn't that be sort of an invitation to governments, even democratic governments in the future, to use the same type of policy when they're confronted with other challenges which are rightly or wrongly perceived to be almost civilizational in nature? What is it that sort of makes us comfortable or at least protected against a democratically elected government in Western European countries that will say climate change is such a civilizational threat to us that the only way we can stop this now is to lock down the countries for a while?
Yeah,
that was sort of makes me worried about civil liberties. But that's just me. What about you?
No, I agree with much of this fear. I'm not surprised by it because this is what happens in times of crisis. All of us want to circle the wagons. We have this collectivist mentality. If there's a threat out there somewhere, you don't want to stand out in the crowd, right? You want to hide behind the others and rally around the flag. In a way. And it's interesting to see how the support for governments and prime ministers and presidents is increasing in almost every country, despite the fact that they have sometimes totally opposite responses to the crisis. And that's what happens. It's as H.L. Mencken, and the essayist and writer put it, the goal of much of practical politics is to keep the populace alarmed and hence clamorous for safety. And he was more cynical about it, but I think this is a deep, natural human instinct. We want the protection of the government, of the strong man, of the chief to protect us and to keep us safe. And then you don't want to be an outsider. You don't want to be the troublemaker. You want to be just like the others when you circle the wagons. And in a way, obviously, we can all agree some of the traditional political bickering between the political parties perhaps should take a break right now because we have major issues to deal with. And that's probably not necessary societal sort of business, so it can wait a couple of months. But at the same time, how we deal with the crisis, what we do, and especially when we've engaged in this massive experiment of shutting down societies and economies to this extent, we need a discussion about the merits of this. And you always act on the basis of your attitudes and the available knowledge. And in that case, the only way to improve it is to make those attitudes and principles explicit and to verbalize the knowledge you have and constantly update it, because that's the only way to criticize it, to examine it, and therefore also to improve on it. So therefore, it's very dangerous whenever we just move towards one answer to the crisis and no one really dares to challenge it. That's when we might make major mistakes. And now that we've engaged in this enormous experiment, I think there is that risk that you're talking about. How do we know that governments are willingly going to give back those powers to the citizens? Well, we know from history that they almost never do. Some of it is given back, but not all of it. And then the capability, the resources at the disposal of government is on a higher trajectory than it was before the crisis. And you also create precedent for the next crisis, because there's always a crisis. There's a financial crisis, global warming, or it's a migration crisis. And once you break through those barriers who said, this is something we cannot do, then it's much easier to walk along that path the next time as well. So I think it's going to be incredibly important to keep a very critical eye on how we now change everything from the ability to shut down borders to closing businesses and taking basically out, banning their very activity, to surveilling the population, because I'm not sure they'll be voluntarily handed back to people.
What would you say is the main lesson of past crises in history, especially pandemics, at least the ones we've had in modern times, and by modern times I mean sort of last 200 years, is the main lesson sort of that new powers that governments took during the crisis that they will remain after the crisis? Or is the main lesson sort of that most governments after a crisis will begin to return some of the powers that they obtained in order to fight the crisis in the first place?
Well, I think that the lesson is that they hand back powers, but they don't return to exactly where they started off before the crisis. It's often something has changed and they keep some of the resources, some of the powers that they had been given during the crisis, especially the fact that they now have a precedent saying that you can do things like this, which you couldn't do before. That makes it much more easy to do the same thing again. You know, during the migration crisis, some of the Schengen countries began to implement new borders against other Schengen countries. And they said, this is the one exception. Only during this crisis, temporarily, we need this. And of course, that nothing is as permanent as a temporary government program, as Milton Friedman put it. So it's been extended again and again, that that temporary exception. And now we do the same thing because of the coronavirus. Then why would we ever go back to that kind of free, open mobility within Europe again? I'm not sure it'll be easy to do something like that. I think we'll remain on at least a higher trajectory. But what has sometimes happened after times of crisis is that even though governments want to keep some of it, populations rebel against it because they don't like it. They don't like the fact that they're suddenly more under government control. And we've seen some strong opposition, some attempts to sort of wriggle out of all the red tape and the control and the surveillance that took place back then. For example, after the Second World War, we saw something like that in many countries. So the answer in a way is, it depends. I'm not willing to bet that politicians and bureaucracies are willingly giving back those powers, but it all depends on whether people will demand it.
One thing that we're seeing already in the debate right now is not among all governments in the West, but at least among some, is this idea that one of the consequences of this crisis, one of the lessons learned, is that we need to renationalize or re-Europeanize supply chains, and that we need to have domestic production capacities of critical medical supply. I've already begun to see some comments coming from, so far, mostly from sort of the likes of people close to Orban in Hungary, but I can see this spreading also to a few other countries, which is that we need to put restriction on the movement of human capital, especially healthcare human capital, in the future. So there should be special restrictions, for instance, for doctors and nurses to move out of countries and to work elsewhere, because they are going to be seen as a national strategic asset and as sort of a core part of any defense against future pandemics. So their freedoms and their liberties will have to be restricted. Things like this is going to be very difficult to change back to sort of the pre-crisis situations once they've been introduced. It's the same thing with the trade barriers that we've seen emerging now. We know from the global financial crisis and its aftermath that many of the crisis-related trade measures that were introduced, well, they are still there. Most of the governments promised that they would take them away once they didn't sort of address the specific concern they had for the moment. But many of these measures were kept in place. And I suppose if we now look at issues like, for instance, the government taking ownership in firms, I can easily sort of see how this is going to be very, very difficult to reform in the future, because once the government has taken a stake, once the government has accepted that the government needs to be there, it needs not just perhaps to be there as an owner, but also as a supplier of cash in order to make sure that companies survive, it's going to be very, very difficult just to take that money away. And that's what really sort of worries me about lasting consequences for measures now, that they are sort of the type of measures that's just going to be very difficult to reform in the future.
Yeah. I think that we will definitely see this argument being made. And as you say, we've already heard it in some areas. I think some of it will be incredibly difficult to get the support of people to really implement it. Like, for example, some kind of control on where people move to work if they are an essential job, like a doctor or healthcare worker. But some of it, there might be more support, I think, when it comes to more of a self-reliance on specific, important, necessary goods that you need. At the same time, I think that will be difficult to implement, because the arguments aren't that strong. You could say certainly that it would be nice to, for every country to have an industry where you produce your own ventilators, obviously, sure, but every ventilator is made up of 500 different components. Now, are you going to have 500 different factories now as well producing that kind of those components as well? In that case, they will be of a fairly, I think, poor quality, ill-fitting, incredibly expensive. So in the end, every country would end up with some sort of, you know, East German Gosplan version of an iron lung rather than a modern ventilator. So I think that the case for international specialization and supply chains is so incredibly strong. Obviously, we now find out that, yes, it's a bad thing to depend completely on a particular country for our supplies of certain components, like China. Sure, that's bad. Does that mean that we should concentrate the supply chain domestically or close to us? I'm not sure, because in that case, the question is, how do we make our societies non-fragile? It's not to concentrate it geographically, because in that case, if anything interrupts us locally, it ruins the entire economy. One of the reasons why we can start some of the industries in Sweden now again is that China has begun to open up again, so that we can get components and supplies from there. Had we relied completely on France and Italy right now, it would have been a complete lockdown. So I think it's more important to discuss how can we make our systems and our businesses and our supply chains more flexible and make sure that we have more of a diversity of suppliers and of geographical areas that we depend on, so that we can shift and change according to circumstances, rather than trying to mobilize everything in response to one particular crisis right now.
That is a very good segue, Johan, to moving into a more optimistic note again, and exactly avoid sort of getting stuck in dystopia. One thing I wanted to ask you, and not just because of the work that you've done now with the new book and the forthcoming book, but also work that you've done in the past sort of around the brain, evolutionary psychology, etc. There is, I think, something interesting with the fact that so many people right now readily jumps into very dystopian visions of the world. And I think the most common one right now is that people look at sort of a dynamic development where we start with the virus. The virus leads to lockdowns. The lockdowns lead to an economic recession. The recession leads to economic depression. Depression leads to protectionism, and protectionism leads to war. So in that scenario, we are now inevitably in a spiral which is going to lead to much, much more confrontations in the world. And as we've talked about, and as you mentioned just recently, well, you know, perhaps, but it's not that there is sort of a very strong logic behind that argument, since resilience and the capacity of societies to actually weather threats also depends on having flexible arrangements and being able to source inputs, get supplies from elsewhere, and not just be dependent on your own domestic capacity to supply with whatever goods you need in order to deal with the crises. Why do you think we so often ends up in these highly dystopian visions of the future when we're confronted with not just perhaps pessimism, but perhaps with uncertainty that, well, no one knows right now what's going to happen to the virus or what, you know, the consequences of it will be for the future. But why is uncertainty prompting us to think dystopian thoughts?
Well, because uncertainty is the worst thing there is.
Why is uncertainty the sort of the most difficult thing?
Because then we don't know how to act. We have to act in some way to deal with our situation, our everyday problems, and the major risks that we are facing. And we have to act on information. And then we need good information or bad information to start acting, or neutral information. But when we don't know what the information is, when we don't know what the situation is, it kind of short circuits and ruins our mental capability to analyze the situation and move onwards with our lives. We've seen very interesting results in this when it comes to health conditions generally. Psychologists have been very surprised to see that sometimes people actually register subjective well-being that improves after they get a bad diagnosis, could even be a threat to their lives, because the worst thing was the weeks or months before they knew anything, before they knew kind of knowledge to act upon in the future. And I think that's where we are right now in for all our societies, because we don't know what's going to happen with the virus, with its mortality, with our societies, with our economy. And then we sort of freeze rather than act. And that's a very uncomfortable situation. And it makes it very easy to begin to ponder the absolutely worst case scenarios. That's the thing that we would have to be prepared for when we don't know what's going to happen. So I think that's why we make these scenarios that are so bad. And obviously, then we're kind of quick to reason from historical analogy, often very simplified ones. It's important to learn from history, but one of the things we learn from history is that we don't learn that much from it, because yes, sometimes we have hyperinflation and an economic depression and an authoritarian takeover and a world war, but that's not what happens every time. It depends on specific decisions, specific circumstances, and oftentimes other things happened after a crisis. That's not really what we remember, because we remember the most dramatic and awful things. So I'd say that we just don't know where this is going to end. It's all dependent on what authoritative people, politicians, major influences on opinion, how they interpret what's happening and what we should do in the next, and public opinion. And that might be dependent on specific events and circumstances, and or even specific data points, or sometimes just the rhetorical power of certain individuals and groups. So it's very much an open future, for good and for ill.
No, I think I can see that. And I mean, going back to what you also started by saying, sort of, you know, if you go to meet a doctor, the really one thing you don't want to hear is basically, "Oh my God, Fredrik, I never seen something like this."
Yeah.
I mean, it's better to tell me that you have cancer, or, you know, you have sort of a chronic heart disease. That's much better information than that the doctor doesn't have a clue, or, you know, what the problem is. So I you know, that I understand. And I think I understand also the rest of what you're saying. But what I wanted to ask is, do you think that societies have become more addicted to certainty, that we are getting less and less capable of being able to manage ourselves in circumstances which are basically defined by a pretty radical uncertainty?
I get that impression, yes. Definitely. We're more worried about uncertainty than before. And, one reason might be that we lead pretty good lives. Nowadays, most people in wealthy Western or industrialized economies lead healthy, long lives with a fair amount of wealth and food on the table. And that's pretty new. So we've got something to lose. I guess if you think of people who suffered from Spanish flu, just 100 years ago, people led very different lives, short lives. Life expectancy around the world was around 40 at that time. People were used to an early death, and that every second child who was born could die before adulthood. And crop failure used to mean famine and death from hunger. In that kind of a society, new uncertainties are bad, and you have to pay attention to them because they might kill you, but they're part of everyday life. It's almost taken into your planning that anything can happen at any point in time. Whereas nowadays, we have much more to lose. We think that we're all going to be 80 or 90 years old, and then obviously any kind of crisis hurts us. We're not used to seeing death at all. And then we're shocked by what we're seeing now. It's interesting to follow how the media reports this pandemic compared to previous ones, even as late ones as the Asian flu and the Hong Kong pandemic in 1957 and 1968. And millions of people died, around 5 million in 1957, I think around 1 million even the first year of the Hong Kong pandemic. And people, they reported it and talked about it, and a couple of articles about how tens of thousands of people had died in this or that country. But it wasn't a drama. It wasn't any kind of shocking reporting where you constantly update what's going on. And I think this is one of the reasons our relative safety and security in this day and age makes us worried when that's suddenly not there. Something cannot be controlled. But also, obviously, this media situation that we can update every second. We couldn't back then. If you hear about something awful that happened in your last week, it's not as shocking as seeing it going on in real time, because that really gets your stress hormones going. And that, I think, is why we constantly update and stress ourselves out.
Yeah, and perhaps in addition to that, one possibly could also say that this form of uncertainty, or so at least being uncomfortable with uncertainty, may also be a consequence of the fact that we've had a fantastic scientific development over the past couple of hundred years, when we know so much more today than we knew in the past about things. We can explain different things in the world, everything from stars to microbes, in a way that simply wasn't possible. And of course, that leads to the aspiration that we can continue to learn more. And as we learn more, we can also control more things, at least, or at least we can at least feel that we are in control over things. But perhaps what's nagging me is perhaps that there is an ideological component here as well in society. And perhaps it's that component which has grown stronger over, well, at least the 20, 30 years when I've been able to watch societal developments and been interested to follow it. And it's the thing that we have problems accepting that things are complex, and accepting that perhaps the best answer to many questions about complex things is that I don't know. I just don't know what's going on here, or what's going to happen. And with the pretense of knowledge that has arrived with wealth, with scientific revolutions, it just make it so much more difficult to say I don't know to pretty fundamental questions about society and the world. But to spin on that theme a little bit more, there are, I think, more things in society today that I could explain in the past that I simply can't explain right now. Things that my education and my profession should be able to explain, like, for instance, how is monetary policy working? What is the consequence of action X on the economy? The best answer quite often is, no one knows, I don't know. There may be people who think they know, but they are really the ones that don't know. Or, can I explain how my electricity bill is being structured to anyone who doesn't have a degree in economics? No, I can't, because I don't understand how the energy price is being set, with all fees and all taxes and different structures of payments going here and there. And I think there is an ideological component in our society which is based on the pretense of knowledge, and that we have the capability to control developments like we can control the temperature in a house. Would you agree?
Oh, I definitely agree that nobody understands the electricity bill. And I also agree with this general tendency. The world is getting more complex, and it should be getting more complex as more people in more places have longer educations in things that we don't understand are free to develop and innovate and create new things. It means that there are more variables going on in the world than we could ever understand what they're about. We can only enjoy the results, hopefully enjoy it. Sometimes we're pained by it. And that's a good thing. It means that more things are going on than I could create myself. When we all lived in and produced in subsistence agriculture, we all understood what our neighbors were doing constantly. The world wasn't that complex. We now, with the level of knowledge, of science, of technology, everything is kind of complex. And when everybody around the world is a player as well in this global society and global economy, that is complex. And that is uncomfortable, because it creates a feeling of being a little bit vulnerable, I think, to a lot of people, especially when things go wrong. You want to understand why and what to do about this. And that kind of uncertainty, I think, is painful to a lot of people. I think it's partly, this tendency towards technocracy, that expert technocrats should decide on things, is one response to this. Another one seems completely contradictory, but I think it's an outflow of the same phenomena. This discomfort with complexity is the populist movement, which I think, when I listen to them and study them, what I find there is not so much specific attitudes on a specific issue, but more like this rejection of complexity. The world shouldn't be this difficult. I should be able to understand it and control it in different ways. And there should be one simple solution to every problem that we're facing. And the only reason why it's not implemented by the government is that government has been taken over by some sort of traitors or someone who does not look after our interests first, but their own. If only we could have our movement in charge or whatever, then we would solve every problem in a simple way. And anyone who's ever thought of concepts like cost benefit and trade-offs and how you make priorities understand that the world is not that simple. It's not that simple. It'll never be that simple. And any attempt to make the world more simple than it is will end up in disaster. But I think that tendency will always be with us to reject the idea that it takes difficult trade-offs to improve the world.
Yeah, wasn't it H.L. Mencken who once said that to every complex problem in the world, there is a solution which is simple, neat, and wrong?
Yeah, good one.
It is, yeah.
Well, for every problem in the world, H.L. Mencken had one perfect one-liner, though.
Exactly. He's sort of the go-to source for any event in life. Johan, to end on a different question, which I also been thinking about lately, is that sort of, is there something that you feel that you've learned over the past couple of weeks and months from this crisis? And by learn, I don't mean sort of facts that you've sort of now been studying textbooks in epidemiology and virology, but sort of a broader lessons about society that you think you didn't think in that way before, or sort of you've corrected some perception that you had. I can mention two for me. If someone had told me 3 months ago that this pandemic would arrive in Europe and that governments would act as panically as they did by closing down societies and sort of doing things that will have huge consequences for the economy, I would have said, no, I don't think that's going to happen. I think governments are going to be so careful about the economic consequences that they will take much more measured and moderate responses. So that's the first thing. The other thing is, if someone had told me, you know what, there's going to be one country who is going to sort of go against the grain, who's not going to fall into line and impose lockdowns, and that's going to be Sweden, I would say, you're completely mad. Sweden is the first country who's going to fall into line, especially if you leave the decision in the hands of the public health authority. Anyway, I've been forced to relearn things about my own society as a consequence of this crisis. Have you learned anything, Johan?
Well, I agree on both those points. I've been shocked to see how quickly it could happen that countries like France, like Britain, can suddenly impose national lockdowns like that. And the fact that they're incredibly popular, it makes me again question how fragile our political institutions are. So that's a bit of a shock. And Sweden has surprised me as well, I agree. And thank you for giving me time to think about something now. While you were talking, I was thinking of two other things. One thing that I've been neglecting for a long time is the idea of having national stockpiles of certain things. Having, you know, the kind of stockpiles that we had during the Cold War with some preserved food with a long extinction date and some important medical drugs, some protective equipment, things like that. A couple of people have sort of emailed me during the years saying that, why don't we have that? That it could be a disaster if a crisis struck. And I've always thought that, yeah, perhaps at some point I should look into that, but not now. Now, during this crisis, I think we've seen the importance of stockpiles like that, particularly because I think I don't know how important they are in a particular situation, and we would have to look at some data on that for countries like Finland and Switzerland who have those stockpiles. But I think that they would have calmed the situation down a bit. I think it would have prevented countries like France and Germany from imposing export bans and shutting down certain borders if they knew that they had some supplies. And therefore, it might even be beneficial for openness and free trade in the long run if governments had some stockpiles of important equipment like that. The other thing is not a new lesson, but I think it's been reinforced again, even more by this crisis, the fact that we always have this mentality of thinking about, now that we evaluate what has happened and what to do next, we are all determined to make sure that exactly the same kind of crisis will not strike in the precisely the same kind of way again. It's always so incredibly easy to, well, second guess what we did before and think that next time around we're going to prepare for a new coronavirus in a great way. And that's the wrong way to go about things. That's exactly the wrong way to think that we should mobilize against one particular known enemy the next time around, because the next crisis will be different. That's why it will be a crisis. You know, 2 years ago, everybody said in Sweden that we should have more of fire fighting equipment because we suddenly have forest fires. We should have an excess supply of those. Now we say that we should have more an excess supply of ventilators constantly. The next time it might be something else, might be a flood, and then we need some sort of protection against that. But that's not how to do it, because if there's a flood or a meteorite or whatever, financial crisis the next time around, the answer is not an excess supply of intensive care units and ventilators. The response, the best response, is flexibility, the ability to constantly shift and change resources to respond to the threat that's at hand right then. For example, it's more important that Sweden has been able to double its number of intensive care units during this crisis than having twice that capability constantly being there and costing lots of resources and perhaps not then helping us to respond to the next crisis, which might be completely different. So we have to think again how we make societies not mobilize against one particular threat, but making them more resilient and diversify, make them more flexible, so that we will hopefully be able to come out of the next crisis when nature throws something completely new and unexpected at us.
I think that's a very important point, Johan. The fight against COVID-19 is not a sort of it's not a preparation for a fight against COVID-20 or COVID-21 or COVID-25. It's more important to think along the lines that you just outlined and create societies that Nicholas Nassim Taleb would call anti-fragile, in the sense that we have resilience and flexibility to move very quickly with whatever threat that will come in the future. Very good, John. I'm very grateful for you taking the time. Thank you so much. I think it's been a very, very good discussion. Good luck with the release, not just of the book that just came out, but also the next one, Open. When is it
due? Thank you. In September. And there's a British edition and a Swedish edition in September, and then we'll see. There are translations coming in.
Very good. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Keep up the good work.
Super. Thanks, Johan.